Russia is protecting Iran, Israel is protecting Greece, America is protecting Venezuela, or at least Venezuelan oil, and Europe is struggling to look after itself. Where are all of these shifting deals and alliances leading? Let's dig in on today's Trumpet World. It's been a while now since we began one of these weekend review episodes talking about the Iran war. We've settled into a bit of a pattern where the war keeps ticking along, oil keeps trickling out through the Strait of Hormuz, Iran is still in the fight, a lot of people are struggling economically because that oil is not getting out in the quantity that it used to. Well, this week we got a look at part of the reason why Iran has been so tenacious. And to hear more about this, we're not going to turn to our Middle Eastern correspondent, as we usually do, but instead to the man who watches Asia, Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, that's right. The big story that I wanted to talk about is that Russia has been helping Iran to make supersonic missiles that pose a serious threat to United States warships. This story was broken by the Financial Times on Tuesday in a report that's based on leaked Russian government documents, and it's corroborated by travel records and also corroborated by analysis of some military patents. So it's quite an explosive report, and it shows that Russia started helping Iran with this very advanced program back in 2023, and that the assistance has continued right on into the current U.S.-Iran war. And the goal of the program is chilling. The goal is to give Iran a new generation of missiles, supersonic missiles that can fly at speeds of up to 2,200 miles per hour, and they can fly at extremely low altitudes, basically hugging the landscape. So these factors add up to make these missiles extremely difficult to intercept, even by the US's most advanced systems. And it means that they could almost certainly strike American warships in the Middle East. So this is extremely high-level technology that Russia has been giving to Iran here. It's something that Iran's wanted badly for years, but Russia only just recently agreed to work with them to develop it in this new program. Analysts also agree that for this kind of very prized, cutting-edge level of technology to be shared, that could only happen at the direction of Russian President Vladimir Putin. You know, it's just a level of tech that would only be shared with another nation on his orders. It's also notable that this week's revelations follow other reports from recent months showing that Russia has also been giving Iran advanced drone technology, and more significantly, that Russia has been giving Iran satellite imagery that has helped them hit specific U.S. assets in the region. Early in the U.S.-Iran war, the Iranians were able to take out one of America's early warning radar systems in Jordan and some other similarly high-value equipment in other areas. And some of those strikes killed U.S. servicemen. So Russia is really helping Iran in some meaningful ways, and that's mainly because Russia just loves to see the U.S. bleeding in any way it can and just being weakened in any way possible. And it's also because Russia wants the U.S.-Iran war to keep going, because that means Western nations are less able to assist Ukraine if they're focused on this war in the Middle East. But whatever Putin's specific motivations are, his assistance to Iran raises some pretty big questions about how U.S. President Donald Trump might respond to this. Because President Trump has warned that any nation maintaining trade ties with Iran, while Trump is trying to pressure Iran with sanctions, will face what he called tremendous economic consequences. That was only 2 weeks ago that President Trump posted that warning. But now we see Putin's Russia going way beyond just maintaining trade ties with Iran. They are doing that with drones and machinery and a range of other goods. But Putin's Russia here is going much further, directly helping Iran build cutting-edge weapons built to strike key U.S. assets. So President Trump has threatened tremendous economic consequences to any nations. That's the way his post was written. But we also know that for whatever reason, President Trump treats Vladimir Putin with great deference. He praises Putin. He calls him a friend. He invited him to the United States last year, rolling out literal red carpet for that meeting. President Trump also still keeps a large photograph of him and Putin standing together, smiling during that meeting. That's on the wall of the White House. President Trump also invited Russia to attend the G20 meeting in Asheville, North Carolina last week. And it's well established that Trump gives Putin a pass on a wide range of activities that he criticizes and punishes other nations for. So the world right now is wondering if Russia will be facing any of those tremendous economic consequences from the U.S., or if President Trump will just give him another pass on helping Iran build these missiles that are constructed to strike U.S. warships. So we'll have to see how that goes. But whatever happens, and whether it is due to Russia's assistance or other dynamics, we can be certain that the current war on Iran will not end with the eradication of Iran's radical Islamic regime. We've got an article that takes a close look at the Bible's prophecies showing that that will not be the outcome of this war. It's by Trumpet Managing Editor Joel Hilliker. It's called, Is Iran's Regime Finished? So for anyone who would like to understand why Iran's regime will not be defeated, I hope you'll check out that article. Once again, it's called, Is Iran's Regime Finished?
Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Quite a thorough report. I don't have too much to add or ask about. But I do find this relationship between the Ukraine war and the Iran war fascinating. The way that in several different issues, this is kind of merging together, where I think even a few weeks ago, you had Ukraine attacking Iranian assets in the Caspian Sea, where the relationship between Russia and Iran has become so close that Ukraine is striking Iran. I mean, how do you see that dynamic? And do you see anything developing from that kind of just becoming... I mean, this is kind of a hallmark of how world wars build sometimes, from smaller conflicts overlapping. I mean, this is like World War II. You have Japan's invasion of China, and then you have Germany annexing Eastern Europe, entirely separate conflicts that start to increasingly draw in other powers. And as they snowball, you know, they eventually merge into one big conflict.
Yes, I do think that the Russia-Iran alliance is a fascinating development and a very significant one. It's one that I don't think many analysts were expecting to be kind of a defining and foundational alliance in this era, but here it is. And I think that it's also put some Russia supporters in a tight spot. Like there's a certain class of American, right-leaning Americans who are inclined to kind of go to Russia's defense in a great number of areas, and even to say, you know, Ukraine is the culpable party in this conflict and America should never be supporting Ukraine. But then once you remind them of Russia's alliance with Iran, it complicates things for some of those would-be Russia supporters, just given the nefarious nature of the Iranian regime. It makes it a little bit more difficult to support them, given, you know, the fact that they've gotten into bed, really, with the Iranians. But you're exactly right, though, that this it complicates many of these conflicts that we're watching. It makes the whole web of alliances and adversaries far more complex. But it shows that the world is entering into a more dangerous era, and we're getting deep into that era.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that, I mean, we know, one of the reasons that we know that Iran isn't going to be taken out by Donald Trump is that the Bible prophesies that it's going to be this European-led king of the north that takes out Iran, this radical Islamist king of the south. And so as you see Iran getting kind of more involved in the Ukraine war and supplying Russia with drones that then get used against Ukraine, I mean, this is starting to bring Europe and Iran more closely into conflict and into contact. Now, you know, Daniel 11, the same passage, talks about Iran pushing at the king of the north. I'm sure there will be a much more dramatic incident that kicks all of this off. But still, you can see that the opposition building between these powers. What else do you have for us from the Asia region?
Yes. Well, first up, a quick story about Japan. We know that Japan's military spending has climbed steadily over the past several years, and it now surpasses $55 billion annually. Just a remarkable shift for a nation that spent decades really restrained by post-war pacifist policies. But the Japanese have been breaking those chains, and they're rapidly building their military power back up. And this week they announced that they're allocating vast amounts of that $55 billion to spending on drones, missiles, and ammunition stockpiles. So Japan is marching toward war, and it is modernizing and expanding its military power, and the nation is just really on the fast track toward once again becoming a major Asia-Pacific military power. And then one final story here about China and Taiwan. We've not heard as much about China's obsession with capturing Taiwan in recent weeks, but that doesn't mean that that obsession has diminished at all. On Wednesday, the Taiwanese Coast Guard announced that the Chinese Communist Party had deployed a record number of Coast Guard vessels and other ships around Taiwan during the month of July. There were a total of 244 Chinese ships deployed around the island in 1 month. So it is a record number. The Chinese remain determined, and their intimidation campaign continues. That's clear from this. And this surge of ships, it really highlights China's growing power and its expanding ability to encircle Taiwan with its maritime forces.
Thank you for that, Jeremiah. Well, the EU received a major blow this week. Iceland voted against European Union membership over the weekend, 52.8% to 47.2%. Now, had Iceland voted yes, they would have negotiated an EU entry deal, and then that final package would have been put to another referendum. So in this vote, a no is kind of permanent, or at least lasting a decade or two, whereas a yes, they would still have a chance to change their minds. Even so, they still voted no to the EU. And this is pretty humiliating for the European Union. They do have a number of Eastern European countries beating their door down to try and get in. But these are poorer countries that want a lot of the economic benefits, the funding, the money from wealthier countries. Iceland has a higher per capita income. This is one of the more wealthy countries, relatively speaking. And they said no. Now, Iceland has long rejected EU membership, largely due to fish. They have fish on every single one of their coins. It's a big deal to them. But it wasn't fish this time. And one of the most humiliating aspects of this to the EU is that the rejection came from young people. In June, a Gallup poll found that 63% of 18 to 29-year-olds said they supported EU membership. So initially, over 60% of young people said, yes, we want in. But in Gallup's last poll before the referendum, that had just about completely flipped, with 60% saying, no, we want out, we don't want the EU, and only 40% of young people saying they wanted to come in. So for the EU, you know, they probably could have handled defeat at supposedly backwards-looking older voters, you know, the way that they would love to dismiss those people's opinions, kind of clinging to the past. But to be spurned this way by the young, well, that raises awkward questions for them. Maybe Europe isn't the future. And I think what this vote highlights is that the EU needs a new vision. The pro-EU campaign focused on kind of logic and numbers and join the EU, and it's going to lower inflation, it's going to raise income and living standards. And the Eurosceptics challenged those claims, rightly in my opinion, but they also focus more on a more emotional message. Rejecting the EU is about freedom and Icelandic identity and controlling our own destiny. And I think the difference between the two campaigns, and I'm not the only one to make this point, highlights Europe's lack of an emotional appeal right now. It had an emotional appeal when it was founded. You look at the decades after World War II and the European Economic Community. Okay, it was a trading community, but it was more the rhetoric around it was about a brotherhood of nations, and it was sold as a way to heal a continent torn apart by war. And this vision of Europe as a force for peace, that doesn't resonate as much now for a generation whose parents and even grandparents didn't experience World War II. And I mean, as anyone who's watched me on this show for any length of time will know, I'm not a pro-EU individual. I'm not saying that the EU is what has brought peace to the continent or that it's filled that role. But I am saying it did have that emotional appeal. And that's not something that it can appeal to young people with any longer. And there is an alternative identity for Europe going forwards. One that the previous generation of European bureaucrats or the older generation don't necessarily want to go down. And that is to build on its Christian and specifically Catholic heritage. And you're getting more and more political parties in Europe appealing to that heritage. And it's that heritage that differentiates Europe from the Muslim migrants pouring across their borders. It's a heritage that a lot of European countries share and that its enemies do not. It's a heritage that you look at other countries and they're using. You know, Vladimir Putin is building a lot on the Russian Orthodox heritage of Russia, or the shared Orthodox heritage of countries outside of Russia's borders. The mullahs in Iran. I mean, you could say even Donald Trump to a certain extent. They use religion as part of their appeal, and even in some cases to build and buttress their political power. Is the EU going to reach for the same tool? Well, it is. The Bible says that it is. And when that happens, a lot of people are going to be quite happy, because it's going to look like a very righteous empire rising up. And what used to be kind of a secular, atheist, godless European Union, there's a lot of people, understandably, that are going to be looking at that and cheering for that as an improvement. But Bible prophecy foretells this turn, and it says that this power that's rising up, well, it's described in Revelation 12 and Revelation 13 and Revelation 17, it says that it looks like a lamb. It's going to look great on the surface, but it speaks like a dragon. You look at that history, you look at its roots, and you can already know, well, yeah, there's a power that's looked like a lamb before, that if you look at it superficially, looks like a great Holy Roman Empire, as it calls itself. All right, great righteous empire that stands up for Christians. That's the surface appeal, but you dig just a little beneath the surface and it speaks like a dragon, and it put other Christians to death. And it stamped down hard on people that wanted to have the Bible out in their local language, for example. And that's not just something that happened after the Protestant Reformation. They stamped down hard on that with smaller movements that tried to translate the Bible and teach people directly from the Bible outside of their interpretation of it, even before the invention of the printing press. And you know, you can absolutely call these times when this Holy Roman Empire dominated Europe as the Dark Ages. And those ages are going to return. We have a really strong article from Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry in the May-June 2026 Trumpet Magazine, Reviving the Dark Ages. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. That will take you through many of those prophecies that tell you what is happening here. But there's a lot of people within Europe that sense the need for change. And it's not just about a change in heritage, a change in rhetoric, the shift in a Catholic direction. There's more to it than that as well. So this week you had France, Germany, the Netherlands, and then eight other European Union members, so 11 in total, sending a joint letter ahead of a meeting of EU foreign ministers trying to push the EU more towards a superstate. They want to get rid of the EU requiring unanimity in foreign policy decisions, which if the EU is ever going to act decisively on the world stage, they absolutely need that. But this is part of the shift away from a Europe of 27 sovereign states and more towards a European superstate. I mean, this EU, for example, several years ago, they're trying to negotiate a trade deal with Canada. And because of this unanimity provision, Wallonia, a part of Belgium, holds up the entire thing because they have the power to block Belgium's vote. Belgium has the power then to block the entire EU vote. And it was a major deal for them to try and work a way around this and deal with this. So they called for this five-step guide to get rid of, to change how the EU does foreign policy. Related to that, there's a new Franco-German plan that was discussed this week that would try and kind of unify the chain of command and give the European Commission president more power. Right now you have the High Representative who basically handles foreign policy, that's Kaja Kallas, and then you've got the European Commission president, and they're pretty independent. And what they want to do is make it more clear that the European president is the one that speaks for the European Union on the external stage and can bring about, or is the one that's mostly responsible in foreign policy. And you would have a relationship where the high representative is more like the Secretary of State. And then the European Commission president is more like the US president, where one is clearly subordinate to the other, and everyone knows who's in charge. So they're working it and they're pushing that type of reform. And then I thought this was fascinating as well, where Mario Draghi has started a new think tank. And Mario Draghi, you know, he was one of the most powerful economists in history. He led the European Central Bank, steering the Eurozone through the Euro crisis, their debt crisis. He was Italian prime minister. Yet all through this, he wanted these kind of steps towards a super state within Europe. And he was more focused on the economic nuts and bolts and the economic aspects that make a super state. Some of the same things that America went through in the early 19th century, you know, what's going to happen to the debt of these different states? Who issues the debt? Does this union borrow as a whole, or do different individual countries borrow? Who handles the taxation policies? The kind of the boring details, but probably the most important details of building a super state. And he wanted Europe to take that step, and he failed. And in 2023, he was appointed by Ursula von der Leyen to investigate Europe's economic and industrial decline and then come up with recommendations. And, you know, well, he continued the same thing. He called for basically a shrunk down European Union that's a smaller super state. And then there's like an inner core and an outer core. Basically, a smaller group of nations moves forwards, and there's ones that don't want to move forwards get left behind. Not much has happened to Draghi's report. So now he's back with this think tank, the Rhine Group. And he and the two other founders, they published a letter, and it's a blistering attack, really, on the EU. He says of the 50 largest technology companies in the world, only four are European. In every emerging technology that will shape the coming decades, Europe is weak. The states are existential. If stagnation continues, the continent will progressively lose the ability to fund the core obligations of a modern state: defense, public health care, pensions, education, climate investment, and safety nets for those who lose their jobs. If we don't solve this technological decline, we're not going to be able to fund our defense. We're not going to be able to fund our welfare states. We're not going to be able to fund our healthcare. And he points out in that letter that America is no longer willing to pay for Europe's defense, and that China is rising as a fierce competitor. And Draghi and the others warn decline is not inevitable, but it is the direction we are heading unless we take urgent action. So I think it's interesting that he tried to bring about this change towards a European superstate, working from within the European bureaucracy. Now he's pushing for change from outside. And Peter Franklin of Unheard had an excellent point. Well, he summarized what Draghi's trying to do, and he said, well, why is he even trying? Why does he even think he's got any chance of success? He tried this for years during the Euro crisis. Nothing really happened. So Franklin writes, well, perhaps it's his leading role in the Euro crisis, during which democratic norms were effectively suspended, that makes him think that he can bring about some change here. This allowed the European Central Bank to impose a policy of extreme austerity on countries like Ireland, Spain, and Portugal. An especially brutal example was made of Greece, despite its left-wing government. It is therefore possible that a future crisis, for instance, a European-wide jump in the cost of servicing public debt or a major attack by a hostile foreign power, could once again force the politicians to submit to the technocrats. For that reason, I recommend we pay close attention to the work of the Rhine Group. This might not just be the output of an elite talking shop, but the embryonic program of an EU emergency government. And that is what Draghi is essentially building here, an EU emergency government. And he is one of the most experienced, well-connected men in finance. In addition to leading the European Central Bank, he led the Financial Stability Board that helped regulate the global financial system after the 2008 financial crisis. He's a Jesuit-trained leader who remains close to the Vatican that we were just talking about. When he was first appointed to the head of the European Central Bank, Mr. Ron Fraser wrote in The Trumpet, "It is of interest in this context to note that the man possesses a Christian name that literally means war, warring, or warlike, Mario. But the surname also intrigues, Draghi, meaning dragon." You know, we were just talking about speaks like a dragon. The Bible makes clear that this soon coming Holy Roman Empire is going to dominate global trade. And Mr. Armstrong forecast repeatedly that a collapse in the American-led financial system would bring this European superstate into being. So could Draghi still have a role? Well, as Mr. Fraser concluded his article, interesting to think on. But Europeans and these different leaders, both within the EU and without, they clearly see the need for radical change. They're all pushing for radical change. And when you do get this financial crisis, whether it's Draghi in charge or not, you're going to see that radical change towards the prophesied European superstate. Now, of course, it's not just a financial crisis that is going to bring this about. It's also going to be pressure from external enemies, from Iran, from Russia. And there was a fair bit this week with Germany under attack from Russia. Germany's government formally blamed Russia for the failed explosive drone attack at Leipzig on August 4th, where you had a drone with explosives found near a Ukrainian cargo plane. The same day, Germany's power grid came under attack with multiple explosive devices planted at an electric substation near Cologne. Somebody knocked 5 coal-fired generating units offline at a particular substation. Nordrhein-Westphalia's interior minister said it was a criminal act, and investigators haven't ruled out sabotage. German investigators identified a Russian-born man who entered the country on a Latvian passport. And he was kind of in the area where this drone took off. And so you're looking at, you've got, okay, fairly low level, but attacks on civilian infrastructure in Germany sponsored by a foreign government. As that escalates, I mean, you could see how this could very easily bring about big changes in Germany. And it already has. Look at what Germany is doing on the military front. And it's going to lead to all of these massive changes all across the European Union. And of course, the Iran war, high oil prices, these are another economic pressure on the European Union. Now, these high oil prices are nowhere near as much of a pressure on the United States. They've got a lot of homegrown oil within the United States, within Canada as well. But the United States is also working to get a hold of Venezuelan oil, and that could be a major boost to them, but also potentially an open door for Europe to move more deeply into Latin America. To hear the latest on this, we'll go to our U.S. correspondent, Andrew Miller.
Yeah, it was last week, about the time we recorded this program, actually, that President Donald Trump negotiated and finalized what could be, depending on how you measure, the largest oil deal in history. Made a deal with the interim government in Venezuela, basically giving the United States access to 65 million barrels of Venezuelan oil reserves spread across 17 different Venezuelan oil fields. President Trump's definitely touting this as the biggest deal in history. He generally touts all his deals as the biggest deal in history. And like I said, there's a little bit depending on how you count, because this is not actually like the United States now owns this oil and it now counts as U.S. oil reserves. It's still a joint venture between the United States and some big U.S. oil companies like Chevron will be involved, and the Venezuelan government to develop this oil. But in any regard, I mean, 65 million barrels is a huge number. And I feel like the geopolitical significance of this is just as important as the economic significance. For the most part, this oil deal hasn't really affected the price of gasoline much, because it was oil already on the global market. Because oil is a globally traded commodity, it's the global supply and demand curves that set the price. So gas prices are still high due to Strait of Hormuz closure, making less oil available on the market. But previously, though, this 65 million barrels of reserves were things that were being extracted and sold on the global market. Much of this was being sent by Venezuela to Cuba. The Venezuelans had a deal where, since Cuba's communist economy is not self-sufficient, they basically sold Venezuelan oil to Cuba at a discounted price to keep the Cuban economy afloat. And in return, the Cubans sent bodyguards and agents and other specialists to keep the Venezuelan government in power. Much of this oil was also being given in economic deals with Russia and China as well. So now that this deal's a joint deal between Venezuela and the United States, like I said, it's not really affecting the price of oil much. It was on the 65 million barrels existed previously. It's not additional oil into the world market. But it's being developed between Venezuela and the United States instead of between Venezuela and China or Venezuela and Russia. And many people in the Trump administration, including President Trump himself and his Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, have really hinted that this oil deal could be key in even bringing about regime change in Cuba. This oil deal with Venezuela was only possible because Donald Trump sent the U.S. military at the beginning of the year to arrest Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Didn't push on towards full regime change, but definitely put in an interim president who's been more willing to make deals like this. And now, because the United States has a controlling stake in this oil, they've got the ability to make sure that it's not going to Cuba. Like I said previously, the Cuban economy is dependent on Venezuelan oil. So if the U.S. controls it and doesn't give it to Cuba, the Cuban economy could fall as well. And I think that's Donald Trump's long-term strategy here. It's really like a geopolitical chess game to give the United States more control over Venezuelan oil, use that oil to pressure regime change in Cuba, and try to shift both Cuba and Venezuela out of Russia and China's sphere of influence into a closer relationship with the United States. So far, that's been working pretty well. As you mentioned previously, or hinted at previously, in both Cuba and Venezuela, the socialist movements have been so embedded over so many years, and they've oppressed the opposition parties for so many years, that really the only organized opposition to Nicolas Maduro's regime and the Cuban Communist Party is the Roman Catholic Church. Cuba was Catholic 500 years before it was communist. So, especially in Cuba, the Trump administration's already working with the Catholic Church to deliver food aid to the Cuban people. They don't want to give the aid to the Cuban government because they'll use it to force the people to support them. So they're setting up the Catholic Church as like a rival power that the Cuban people can get their food aid for. There's also similar things in Venezuela, where the Venezuelan Bishops' Conference is the most powerful opposition force. So the United States needs to work with the Bishops' Conference. And to the point where they actually we had to sit down and talk with the Vatican Secretary of State before we arrested Maduro at the beginning of the year. So that is the flip side of this, is we're definitely working with the bishops in Cuba, the bishops in Venezuela, and the Vatican itself in order to pressure these countries out of Russia and China's sphere of influence into America's sphere of influence. Very similar strategy that Reagan took to taking down the Soviet Union. Had to work with the Catholic Church to use Poland as a wedge to break it. Which in the short term, like I said, seems to be working out very well. From a Bible prophecy standpoint, the late Herbert Armstrong prophesied for years that it wasn't ultimately going to be Russia or China that invaded America. It was going to be a resurrected European power led by the Roman Catholic Church. And so this strategy of working with the Roman Catholic Church to get deals like this done, and I actually don't know if the Roman Catholic Church was very supportive of this particular deal, but definitely they're supportive of making sure the people in those areas are fed and get medical supplies and things like that if the Maduro regime or the Castro regime falls, is setting up a circumstance where you're pushing out one American rival at the expense of empowering another.
Great. Thanks for that. I think that's a really, that's a part of this deal that no one really else is talking about. And when you look at the oil reserves that it includes, I think probably is by far the most important. I mean, have you seen the story, Andrew, that apparently the vast majority of these reserves, they're in the Orinoco Basin, they're not economical to extract unless oil is consistently above $80 a barrel for quite a long time, meaning that most oil in other places of the world is just going to be cheaper to get to. So it seems like a lot of this oil may well just stay in the ground and never be economically viable to get it out. So the geopolitical ramifications of this would be much more important than just the effect of the oil itself, which is just more of a paper asset than something that can really be used.
Yeah, I did see that. And I actually used to work in research and development, developing some propens and different products for extracting oil and natural gas reserves from shale formations. And it's similar math here in the United States. In Saudi Arabia is very fortunate that way. They've all got conventional oil reserves. The oil's in sandstone. You drill a hole, you drop a pipe, you put a big pump on the pipe, you suck the oil out. It's very easy. Your costs are about $10 a barrel. As long as oil's trading more than $10 a barrel, you make money. In the United States, with our shale formations, where you've got to pipe fluids in at high pressure, fracture the shale formations, pack it with high-strength sands, it's much more involved. So it's closer to the Venezuela numbers. You need at least $50 a barrel to break even. In some formations, maybe 60 or 70. So if oil's not above that, it's no longer economical to extract. So the Venezuelan fields, they're not much worse than the American fields. And if oil prices got high enough, they would be a reserve that you could rely on, which is nice to have that reserve to fall back on. But it is another reason why you're like, well, how is it that Trump got 65 million barrels of oil and like I'm still spending $3.50 a gallon to fill up my tank? Like you said, they are fields that are expensive to develop. It's not glutting the world with oil in the way that Middle Eastern oil would. It mainly serves as a reserve in cases that, like, if the Strait of Hormuz shut down and oil spikes to over $100 a barrel, we've got another source we've got a backup source that's now makes sense to use. But also just like the geopolitical angle. Is that like Cuba, George Friedman at Geopolitical Futures does a good job of explaining this, that like the Battle of New Orleans and the War of 1812 is not something that gets much attention, even here in American schools where we learn quite a bit about the War of 1812. It's kind of like, okay, we were fighting Britain and like Andrew Jackson did something at New Orleans on the sidelines of this battle, saying that it was actually probably the most important battle of that war. The fact that we had control over the mouth to the Mississippi River, because much of America's power is based on you've got the world's largest contiguous piece of arable land connected by the world's longest navigable river system. You're funneling all this agricultural and industrial produce downriver to this extremely significant port in New Orleans, which then is shipped out either through the Straits of Yucatan or the Florida Channel, or the, I think it's the other way, the Yucatan Channel and the Straits of Florida, to the wider world. And so, so Cuba's kind of like the cork in the bottle of what's now the Gulf of America. And so just like New Orleans was important, what Theodore Roosevelt did in Cuba was important. It's a geographic choke point that if you could close off that Cuba choke point, you basically close off the entire Mississippi River basin from the rest of the world. So geopolitically, control over Cuba is way, 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 like orders of magnitude more important than 65 million barrels of oil, or even our relationship with Venezuela. But the Venezuela angle, geopolitically, Venezuela is important as it's Cuba's main source of oil. We may not need Cuba's 65 million barrels, but Cuba sure does. And so making sure that we control that oil, even if it is expensive to extract, gives us a lever over Cuba, which is the real existential threat to the U.S. George Friedman called that back in January when Trump first arrested Maduro. And he said, the arrest of Maduro is more about Cuba than it is about Venezuela. You have to connect a few dots to see how it's more about Cuba than it is about Venezuela. But I think he's absolutely right that this deal to get this oil is really about making sure that we keep our trade route between the Mississippi River Basin and the Atlantic Ocean open.
Great point. Well, fair bit about oil, Latin America. What else do you have for us from the English-speaking world?
Yeah, some other financial-related news, actually some pretty bad financial-related news, is we're in September now, and unlike the normal calendar, which ends in January, the new fiscal year starts September 30th, a couple weeks away. And so we're looking at the numbers. We've got about 20-some days before we have the final numbers, but we can estimate roughly what they're going to be. And the United States is going to spend 18.6% of its tax revenue on interest payments this year. That's a new all-time record, higher than the 18.5% we spent last year, which was the previous all-time record going back all the way to 1991 when we spent 18.4%. So that's about one in every $6 collected in taxes goes to interest, which is kind of a metric. I feel like 18% something that a lot of financial analysts use, that like you're not past the point of no return, but you're getting close to it. Because one bond crisis, you could get to a point where you're spending 30% of tax revenue and you basically don't have enough money left in your budget to pay for everything. And you get to a point where you basically have to borrow money to pay the interest on your previous debt. That's pretty much what happened to the British Empire when it finally went bust, is their debt to GDP ratio went up to like 260% after World War II. You weren't even able to pay the principal on those loans. And so America made them a really good deal in 1946, where they're like, we'll lend you a bunch of money at like an insanely low interest rate, but not out of the goodness of our hearts. We want some economic concessions that ensures the dollar's the new reserve currency. So once you start seeing those type of numbers, you're getting up getting up towards above 20% soon of your interest going to national debt. It is showing that even secular analysts who are not informed by Bible prophecy think that the dollar will likely lose its reserve currency status in the next 20 years, probably in the mid 40s, 2045 maybe. But then if you believe in Bible prophecy, and then you're looking at like, okay, well, if Europe unites into a 10-nation fiscal union and presents the world with an alternate reserve currency, that could happen much sooner. Anyway, spent a little more time on that than I thought I was going to for in other news, but so I'll be quick with the other two stories. One is a pretty popular Fox News host, Marito Bartiromo, was fired this week. She wanted to cover a story about China hacking into U.S. election systems. Her superiors at Fox News did not want to talk about Chinese influence in U.S. elections. So they told her she couldn't cover it. She sent some of the text messages to someone in the White House. Fox News found out about it and did not like the fact that one of their journalists was working with the Trump administration and fired her for that. So just showing the bias in American media about like what stories you're allowed to talk about and what stories you're not allowed to talk about. And another shocking one that we've written a little about in our morning briefs about a trial going on in America this week about a woman who strangled three of her children to death and then claimed that she was suffering from bipolar disorder and wasn't legally responsible for her actions. This has gone to court and it's drug on for many days now. I feel like we're into like our sixth or seventh day of jury deliberations with protesters outside and even the jury saying that her bipolar disorder means that she should not be punished for strangling her own children. I think right now they're down to there's one juror holding out. And if they can get this one juror to crack, she'll be let off the hook. So there's basically like one juror between the difference of like, is she going to be convicted for murder? Or are they going to say is like, oh, well, she was depressed when she did it. So it's, you can't legally be held accountable. So we'll, I'm sure I'll maybe mention that next week when we actually find out what the jury decides. But definitely a big proof of a nation without natural affection that, like, you get to a point when a woman can literally strangle her own children. And the consensus of a jury seems to be trending towards the fact, like, oh, well, she had bipolar disorder and she was depressed. So it's not her fault.
Yeah, pretty shocking story. Well, thank you for that, Andrew. Mihailo Dekic isn't in today. So instead, he sent in this report on the news this week from the Middle East.
Israel and Greece agreed to their largest defense deal ever on August 31st in a program called Achilles Shield, named after, of course, the famous hero from Greek mythology. And Greece is probably looking for some superhuman, so to speak, powers to protect itself. It's valued at about $3.5 billion. To give some perspective, Israel's largest defense deal ever with Germany in 2023 was valued at $4 billion. So this is approaching that. What exactly does Greece get out of this? Well, it will receive access to some of Israel's cutting-edge, famous surface-to-air missile defense systems, like David Sling was used very prominently to shoot down Iranian missiles in the recent wars. Barak MX, Spider. Basically, like Iron Dome, what most people are familiar with, but up a notch to protect from threats more advanced and potentially lethal than just the makeshift Hamas rockets. Rafael, meanwhile, the Israeli defense giant, also agreed to build what Reuters called a, quote, new national command and control system, or basically more technological communication systems for the Greek defense systems at large. Rafael also, in a separate agreement with Greece, agreed to on the same day, worth about $30 million, agreed to give Greece a what they call a drone dome system. Essentially, in a nutshell, all of these components are making Greece's defense capabilities, especially in regards to intercepting missiles, about as equal as Israel's is. Why are Why is Israel doing this deal with Greece? I mean, aside from the money, why is Israel getting friendly with Greece? Why do they trust Greece with this? Well, basically it boils down to Turkey. Technically speaking, Greece and Turkey are allies in NATO, but they have a long history of fighting with each other. I'm not just talking about historically hundreds of years ago. They've had conflicts in places like Cyprus. They've always been afraid that one or the other may do some kind of attack. And Israel, meanwhile, for anybody that's followed this show for much time, they don't have good relationships with... They don't have a good relationship with Turkey and haven't for quite a few years. Israel lately, because of Turkey's activities in Syria, propping up the Islamist regime there, propping up Hamas, of course, for years, a lot of the rhetoric coming from President Erdogan over there, is seeing Turkey as more and more of an immediate threat. And as the old adage goes, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And if you want to make friends with Turkey's enemies, you have to make friends with Greece. And for Greece's part, compared to most of Israel's other neighbors or partners, they've actually been what appears to be fairly reliable over the years. This is the largest defense deal between the two countries, but it is definitely not the only defense agreement that these two countries have had. They've also cooperated in energy. There's been a ambitious development program in getting Greece and Cyprus hooked up with Israeli natural gas through an undersea pipeline. That's also something Turkey opposes. Greece very much looks like, at least in Israel's immediate neighborhood, the best friend and most reliable friend they could have. But in light of Bible prophecy, this is definitely an interesting trend to keep an eye on. When Israel announced its Arrow 3 program a few years ago, that's basically another missile defense system, except it's intended for targets potentially even outside of Earth's atmosphere. It is the most advanced long range of Israel's defense systems. And at the time, we were saying that Israel is basically trusting its most sensitive technology, including avenues to explore backends, kill switches, inherent flaws, to Germany. And in many prophecies in places like Daniel 11, Ezekiel 23, Revelation 17, our predecessor magazine, The Plain Truth, under Herbert W. Armstrong, has been predicting for decades and decades that Germany and its European allies are going to eventually betray Israel, conquer the Jewish state, and treat the Jews like Germany did in World War II. And for Israel to be cozying up with Germany like this to basically show its hand, let Germany know how to work its defense systems, how to sabotage them if it would like, that's going to play into Germany's strategy of attacking Israel. We'll examine one of these prophecies that speaks of this. In Daniel 11, speaks of an end-time clash between Germany and its allies versus radical Islam. Our editor-in-chief, Mr. Fleury's free book, The King of the South, explains that in detail. We've been hitting that prophecy quite hard for months now. But I want to focus on verse 41. We generally skip over verse 41 in this great conflict. And it says that the king of the north, or German-led Europe, will, quote, enter also into the glorious land, or the Holy Land, the state of Israel today. And this is what Mr. Fleury writes in The King of the South, quote, the Hebrew indicates this is a peaceful entry, not forced. The Jews appear to invite them in as peacekeepers. After war explodes in the Middle East, there will probably be a thunderous call for a peacekeeper in Jerusalem. The king of the north will no doubt take the job, but it leads to a great double cross. End quote. Now, this plays definitely into what we're seeing with Greece right now. Okay, Greece isn't Germany, but it's still allied with the European Union. It's part of the European Union. It's allied with Germany. It's still part of the German system. We've spoken years ago about how Greece's debt crisis showed that it essentially is becoming a vassal state to Germany. And more to Germany, to other countries in Germany's orbit, Israel is showing exactly how its defense systems work, how they can be altered, basically leaving itself vulnerable. You don't show these kinds of details to countries you don't trust. And Israel has a well-deserved reputation for being a military heavyweight, especially relative to its size, of having this unstoppable technology. But what good is any of that technology if the enemy already knows how it can be worked and how it can be circumvented? So you can definitely see Israel setting itself up for this double cross, both in its trust of Europe and its trust of what which countries it feels it can rely on, and just these countries getting a sense on how Israel defends itself and potentially how to beat those systems. That's the main story from the Middle East. I wanted to bring this one more. I'd like to highlight on Tuesday, the International Atomic Energy Agency, that's the UN's, a lot of people dub them the nuclear watchdog, they sent a report to its member states about Iran's nuclear program. And it doesn't really have many details, but that's the point. Since the strikes on the nuclear program last year, not this current war, the one in 2025, Iran still has not allowed the UN to come look at its nuclear sites. And the UN is saying, regarding the enriched uranium, whatever happened to it, regarding how many centrifuges Iran still has active and what it's doing with them, we still don't know. We have no way of knowing. If it was the UN was confident that these would have been destroyed or that otherwise Iran couldn't operate them, they would have said so. But in the report, headed by Rafael Grossi, the head guy of the agency, we've quoted from him many times before, they're saying, we're still concerned that this can still be weaponized. And the fact that we're in the dark about this is making us even more concerned. When the current war started, a lot of people said, well, I guess that's going to be the end of Iran, that's going to be the end of the Islamic Republic, the end of their nuclear program. Even now, after 6 months of when the war started in February, you're having arguably the most qualified experts in the world looking at Iran's nuclear program and saying, we don't know, they could still do something with it. And we're really nervous about this potentiality. Mr. Fleury has highlighted how we need to keep our eyes on Iran's nuclear program. This is going to play a huge role in the events of Daniel 11, as we've been highlighting, and it will be definitely interesting to see where this trend goes in the future.
Well, thank you for that, Mihailo. That is it for today's show. Thank you to Matthew Friesen for engineering and production. I'll point you once again to that article, Reviving the Dark Ages, from our Summer Trumpet print magazine. If you're not subscribed, make sure you sign up to get our Trumpet magazine 10 times a year, roughly monthly, whenever it comes hot off the press. We'd be very happy to send that to you, and you can get all of our most substantive, most important coverage straight through your door, showing how all of these events tie right in with Bible prophecy, showing you God's hand in world events and where all these different events are leading. You can sign up for that on our website, thetrumpet.com. You can send us any questions or comments at trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. Thanks again for joining us. We'll be back on Wednesday. Until then, keep watching your world.